Welcome to the Accessible Altar. I'm Stephanie Shockley.
And I'm Robin King.
And we are your hosts. Today we are in conversation with Kristen Tossel Pitts. Kristen is an Episcopal priest and a school chaplain whose vocation focuses on the intersection of spiritual formation and gospel-centered justice. She currently serves as the chaplain and director of spiritual and cultural learning at Washington Episcopal School in Bethesda, Maryland. Kristen lives with lupus and other autoimmune conditions, as well as ADHD. She and her wife live in Maryland with their toddler, cats, poetry collection, and mildly chaotic native plant garden. Kristen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We are delighted to have you here, and especially delighted to talk about worship accessibility with you, which is a topic I feel like we have circled and will inevitably come back to again and again. Before we get to some of those details, can you tell us a little bit about how that interacts with your faith life and your sort of religious roles in professional ways?
Yeah, definitely. So I have systemic lupus, and I was diagnosed with that right as I was graduating seminary and being ordained to the diaconate. So in the Episcopal Church, we're ordained deacons before priests. And so I was starting my first call, which was in parish and university ministry, just very shortly after my diagnosis. So I'd been sick for a long time, but was having to learn how to work with my body and manage my illness while also learning how to be a parish priest and a minister in God's church. So that was a lot. I am fortunate that I was diagnosed before significant organ damage occurred, which often happens with lupus, but I did have substantial symptoms. So extreme fatigue. At that point, I was sleeping something like 14 hours a day. I had a lot of what we call brain fog. So exactly what it sounds like, right? Where there's basically a big fog in your brain and you're trying to claw your way through it just to think or remember things or call up words. And I had pretty substantial joint pain because lupus can cause arthritis as well.
On top of all of that, you're also doing your first year of ministry, which is exhausting without any health considerations in play.
Exactly. So it was a pretty wild time, honestly. So what it did though was made me realize what a challenge it is to be deeply involved in church life with a disabled body. And so I, you know, was navigating that from the get-go in this. It's been a huge learning experience. It was something I was interested in before, you know, accessibility in the church, but have a very different view of now, obviously.
Where did your interest in that sort of accessibility in the church start?
Yeah, I had an interest in various marginalized identities theology for a long time and kind of worked on that a lot when I was in seminary. I got to do some research in those areas. And so it was largely from this sort of call to God's justice and the church's connection to that. So I had done some reading around disability theology and things of that nature previously and was coming to realize what a need there was in our tradition for that. And then obviously when it turned out that my own body had a lot of extra needs that I had not previously discerned, got much more involved.
So yeah, you went from like light interest to, oh, this is critical for me in some ways really fast.
Exactly. Yes.
Did having some of that pre-existing knowledge help make that transition?
I think it did, but it's also that weird dynamic where, okay, like I'm going to jump to queer life for a minute. So it's kind of like, you know, if a family is super supportive, like very pro-gay rights, et cetera, But then when it's their kid, it's like a different experience and more of a challenge. It's kind of was the same thing. Like, oh, yes, you know, I understand, you know, at least to a certain extent, like disability theology. I think it's really awesome, a beautiful lens through which to interact with God and the church. But then when it's my own body, it's not as if having that understanding stopped the grief or the hard things that came with that experience. So it was navigating it in a new way. It's kind of like, you know, I had a bit of a start on the journey and was more ready to explore that than I think I would have been otherwise. But yeah, it was still a lot.
That makes a lot of sense.
So I'm really curious how others in your ministry sphere reacted to newly ordained, you know, right out of seminary, newly ordained, baby deacon, baby priest. You, as you went through all these health issues, and we've talked in other episodes and with other clergy about the culture of overwork and perfectionism that pervades some corners of the church. And, you know, it's a real thing. So I'm wondering how others in your, you know, in your circles, in your parish, in your ministry handled what was happening with you.
It was very intense. I will say I was working really hard to hide it. It took a while for me to be comfortable being open about my diagnosis and the challenges that came with that. Partially because I was still in the ordination process, right? As a deacon, I still had some more steps to complete to be ordained a priest. And I was honestly very concerned about what being honest about my health condition would do to that process. So I worked super hard to hide it. I brought my wife with me to church a lot. She's not religious, but she would come to church with me to provide kind of practical support and to be my brain during coffee hour, because by the time I got done with services, my brain was just shot, couldn't do anything else. So basically I would just stick to her during coffee hour and she would carry on conversations with parishioners. So yeah, it was real wild. Once I got comfortable and started being more open about it, I think it was received well, but I had had a lot of work that I needed to do before that. And it was definitely something that was explicitly stated to me at times that people with my kind of condition wouldn't make it in ministry.
That's a pretty common experience if you start disclosing health stuff.
We have heard that before.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, it feels like a very precarious place to be because, especially if you're in a new relationship with your ministry community.
I mean, that's a precarious place to be regardless. You don't know the landscape.
Yeah, I think we've even seen it in recent years. I certainly know I can think of a case a while back in my diocese and in other places, even with bishops, where the first question after a diagnosis was that people started to raise was, well, can they do it? Can they do it? Why should they resign? Maybe they should resign. They should resign. I don't know if they can. This is something that they're going to be able to do. And, you know, so knowing that it comes at that level, that question happens at that level, kind of, yeah, it does give you a sense of what might be happening everywhere else. And then, like you said, you are the most vulnerable in that ordination period. And they make it very clear, at least I remember it being very clear, that you can be dropped at any time for any reason.
Right. Well, and there's actual health exams as part of the process, right? That's
yeah.
a canonical requirement.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It's not like a subtle thing that your health can impact your process.
Right. Right.
And I don't think that's necessarily the worst thing. I know people, those health exams caught significant diagnoses for, but when they happen in a culture that is so steeped in ableism and uncritical of how clergy work has issued demands and we've been expected to just do the things, it is incredibly vulnerable and risky.
Mm-hmm.
So aside from I'm assuming fully being priesthood and sort of ending that ordination period of higher scrutiny and questions and vulnerability. What else helped you become more comfortable disclosing your health?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of us in ministry kind of have an immediate teaching instinct. Like when we're dealing with something and processing it ourselves, as soon as we make any progress, we say, oh, we'll share this with others, right? We'll share what we've learned so others can follow our lead. Which is not a, you know, it's not a bad thing, but I would definitely say that that was part of my experience. Was as I recovered, as I learned more how to work with my body, I was definitely drawn to being open about it, partially to help others and partially from an advocacy perspective. And also I was learning how to do my work in a way that was at least tolerable for my body at that time. And I think that that helped too, because I think I had this deep fear initially. I don't say I think, I know I had this deep fear initially that lupus would keep me from being the priest I wanted to be, the spouse I wanted to be, the parent I wanted to be. And I had to wrestle with that a lot to be able to kind of move forward and claim that, yes, this is limiting in some really important ways, and I have to grieve that. But also, there are gifts in it, right? I know how to navigate challenges with my spouse, and we learned that very early, partially due to lupus, right? I know how to support others in significant illness because I have dealt with it, right? So there are pieces about that in ministry that became clearer to me, and I was able to then kind of claim that.
I love how you articulated that tie between figuring out how to sort of create your own accommodations at work and the need to explain and share those. I know for me, that's been such a powerful thing of saying, oh, no, there's a way to do that. You're not trapped in this.
Exactly, right? The kind of ability to help others empowers you.
And one of the themes that is so common with any disability accommodation is it's often really good for non-disabled people, too.
We talk about that a lot in my work now because I oversee our diversity, equity, and inclusion work at my school. And we talk about the curb cut effect, right? Mm-hmm. You do something to help one population, but it ends up helping others. So yes, curb cuts provide wheelchair access, but oh my gosh, as somebody who pushes a stroller down the sidewalk, I can attest that it also helps me, right? And many others.
One of my favorite little ones is if you ask people what their favorite vegetable peeler is, it's almost never the ones I grew up with, which are like the metal hourglass ones.
Oh, yeah.
Because it turns out we all like the ones they designed for old people with arthritis better because they are just more comfortable.
The like the ones with the big squishy rubber handle. That's what I have.
Yep.
Yes. 1000%. All of that.
Yeah. It's true. It's so many different ways. And so I have a lot of, in my life, I spent a lot of time dealing with my own accommodations. In fact, to the point that accommodations in worship have been sort of, for others have been almost secondary for me, but I've been working on trying to bring more people in. But I suspect that my accommodations might be different or be very different than yours. So tell me some of the things that you have learned that are accommodations in worship that work just not just for you, but that really seem to be helpful for, well, I want to hear about you first, but also how that works for others. Because again, I bet you found that people have said, oh my gosh, that is so helpful, or that makes it so much better.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because so much of my work now has been in schools that I often think about it more in terms of a classroom lens. And then say, how does that apply in church? But for me, I know, you know, one thing that was tough in parish life was just the physical distance involved in moving around a parish, right? When you have extreme fatigue, going back and forth from, you know, your office to the sacristy, to the parish hall, and so on. It's just, it's a lot of steps. It's a lot of moving your body. And so I would work really hard to try to minimize that.
So say, and no matter how hard you minimize that, you'll be halfway between two places and someone will urgently need something in the place you just came from.
Honestly, right. Or, you know, because brain fog and ADHD brain, I would have left a thing I critically needed in the place that I just was and have to go all the way back for it. So yeah, that's like definitely a piece, is just navigating space, navigating stairs was challenging for me at that time. And so kind of, again, minimizing going up and down stairs. And the church that I was at, the way the space was set up to get to my office was down a flight of stairs and then up two flights of stairs. So it was just like entering the building was kind of a thing.
There's a church building logic to that setup that is just so church building logic.
Yes.
So this is so interesting because actually some of your thoughts on accommodations, some of them are different than what mine would be, but some of them do intersect because I don't have good depth perception. I don't love random surprise sets of stairs, for example, right? And I'm thinking about, I have a high altar. We have an east-facing altar. And I was thinking about, and I mean, I've learned at times when I have been ill that, you know, being at that east-facing altar, you spend a lot of time thinking, don't lose your balance. Don't fall backwards. Don't fall backwards. Don't fall. Because when you don't feel well, it's very easy to kind of get the vertigo and to just feel very uncomfortable in that space very quickly. And I'm imagining with extreme fatigue, you know, like a lot of our altars are, don't even feel safe because you could easily make a mistake, lose your presence of mind, lose your balance, trip backwards, yeah, or sideways.
Yeah. And I also had, like muscle weakness. I would shake a lot because my muscles were just not able to maintain movement very well. So I was prone to tripping, stumbling a lot. And then at the altar, right, you've got all these very delicate things.
Uh-huh.
And you're wearing, you know, a robe with giant sleeves.
Yes.
And trying to like navigate my short self, right? Like I'm 5'3", so an altar in a standard Episcopal church is already uncomfortably high for me.
Yes.
I'm like waving my arms around in the air very slowly, trying to avoid knocking over the chalice or whatnot. Yeah, that was a thing. I move very slowly. I speak very slowly in that setting for that reason.
These are all very familiar things to me. My goodness.
What are the ongoing accommodations that help make worship a more worship-filled place for you?
Oh, that's a great question. So, you know, what's interesting is now I'm a participant again. And also, you know, we've been in a pandemic and I'm immunocompromised and immunosuppressed. So there's kind of a lot going on there.
So
in terms,
live streamed church is the short answer.
This live stream church is the answer. Yes. I think, you know, online church has been a real gift to a lot of people, and a lot of churches learned how to do it really well. And mine, I think the church that I attend did a really amazing job. Props to our priest, Emily, for orchestrating that. But what it was that it's not just a live stream. It's a service where you get to interact with each other. It's a service where people on Zoom are leading, right? So it's a participation. It's a more of a sense of community than if you're just watching the service. Those are two different experiences, right? And then, you know, we would hang out and chat on Zoom afterward. I go to a small service, so I recognize that that's more complicated with, you know, larger services with more people and such. But it was a gift. And one thing that I love, actually, you know, the church moved back to in-person services, but my service has remained hybrid.
Nice.
So we actually have, yeah, it's so cool. I love it. I think it's such a good model for, you know, for accessibility for so many churches, because we have a big screen at the front of the worship space. So the people who are present on site can see the people who are on Zoom and vice versa. So there's a camera facing the congregation for them, as well as a camera facing the altar. And so there's much more interaction there. And then the people who are online also help lead the service. So they might lead the prayers or do a reading or whatnot. We interact at the piece. It's a very, very cool thing. And I'm super grateful for that.
Yeah, I only know of a couple churches who manage that level of interactivity, like once they move back into their space.
We are not. It actually, for me, it is. It winds up being an accessibility clash, actually, because visually that you're talking about something that for me visually is like, there's no way I can manage that.
Oh, sure.
However, I've seen it done. Our diocese does it extremely well. And it means, you know, participation, not only in worship services where you've got it, you know, in a hybrid format, but they did a bishop's election in a hybrid format. They do clergy conference in a hybrid format and diocesan and convention in a hybrid format. And people online are participating just as much. And when you can do it, my goodness, it is so good. And I have benefited from it so much because for me, it's a transportation issue. And so to be able to be fully participating in one of these things and sitting at my desk and not having to figure out how in the world I'm getting somewhere 2.5 hours away, oh my gosh, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it's exactly that thing that we were talking about, right? The, you know, improving access for some tends to improve access for everyone. I think about, you know, how many people would not make it to an evening Bible study because, you know, they're working or, you know, have other obligations in the evening or just their body doesn't allow them to add that extra physical load on, and but they could do it from home. They could do it on Zoom. It's that same thing. And I think too, you know, thinking about accommodations kind of on site, one thing that's helpful in my congregation is that the priest really models, what am I trying to say? She really models kind of a hospitable culture. So at this point, you know, I have an almost 2-year-old and we go, and from day one, it has been clear that his noises, his movements, his running around the space, we're all very welcome. And I think the same thing is true for me and my body's needs in there. I don't worry at all about, you know, eating and drinking in the service if that's what I need to do. I don't worry at all about getting up and moving around if that's what I need to do. It's huge. It's huge to just have that kind of culture where everyone and everyone's needs are invited to be a part.
And I think that does go back to your thing about, you know, the discussion about how accommodations for one need wind up helping so many other people. I mean, the kind of flexibility that you're talking about there is such a big deal for families. So it's not just for elderly people with mobility issues or for people with health issues or disabilities, but just for families to be able to come in and out of the space, to not worry about whatever is happening in their pew, and just for things to be flexible, you know, just it's such a big deal. We have so many churches that are saying we want young families, but they don't fully grasp the hospitality that might make people feel comfortable in their space and not embarrassed when things are a little chaotic.
Yeah. I wonder a lot about, you know, when you're talking about community culture, that's a thing that can be harder to shift and takes kind of a lot of intentional work and intentional modeling. And I always think that, you know, not only do the clergy need to model that, but they need to help get lay leaders on board with modeling that as well, right? And say, you know, here's our expectations. People and their families and their bodies have a whole lot of different needs, and we want to support that. You know, it needs to be okay for people to eat and drink in a service. It needs to be okay for people to get up and move around in a service. It needs to be okay for somebody to make noise in the service. And I think, you know, not only is that important for the clergy to model, but I think it's important for lay leadership. And, you know, we can support that by having that explicit conversation with our lay leaders and giving them language to use when people complain. Because, you know, a lot of times people won't come to the clergy and say, oh, did you see that person, you know, walking around in the back of the church during the service? They'll go to somebody else who they think is going to go tell the clergy person on their behalf. And so they, I think the leaders need that language to say, oh, you know, yeah, I did notice that. I'm so glad they felt comfortable doing what they needed in our space. Thank you for welcoming them.
This is the thing I've discovered I like most. I do a pre-service announcement about how we are in a tradition that has a lot of movement. I don't announce it. I want you to make the choices that help you worship God, because it gives me language to pivot to, and I hope it gives other lay leaders and other leadership in the church language. Well, it sounds like they were doing what helped them worship God.
Yeah, I love
that. And we're going to trust that that is what they were doing.
A principle of universal design is providing flexibility, providing options, right? And the more that we can proactively provide options, the better we will serve our people. And I think too, when you're talking about like prayer postures, right? If you're in a church where kneeling is the custom for prayer or receiving communion or whatnot, providing options up front and being explicit about that. And then, you know, if you worry about whether people will be comfortable, see if you can find some people in the congregation who are willing to stand for prayer or, you know, use what do we want to term this for a podcast audience?
The, like, hands up, or the fancy term would be like orans, but like hands up, palms up.
Right, orans, hands. And I'm like, I don't know if that translates. So I'm sitting here on the screen holding my hands up and hoping you will help me. But yeah, like teaching people different prayer postures and inviting, you know, some of our congregants to use those so that there's a model for others in our space, right? Because, you know, kneeling is very painful for me. And it's awkward to be the one person who's not kneeling. It's just weird, especially if you're a person who people would look at and expect to follow along.
I mean, when you're the celebrant, whatever you're doing goes. When, you know, whatever you do is fine, but that's right. I forget about that actually now that you mention it. As the celebrant, I do what I need to do, right? But when you're in the pew, it's a lot harder to do what you need to do.
My current churches are the first places I've showed up to with that pre-service announcement. And it takes about 6 months of that announcement, like 6 months of fairly regular in-building worship, because pandemics are things, for people to start assuming I might mean it. And even as a celebrant, like, I do what I am going to do. But if I'm doing something different than I usually do, which sometimes I do for a variety of reasons, including it is not a high spoon day, I will get weird looks from people who are like, are we supposed to be doing that too? And I'm like, no, do whatever works for you.
I refer you back to the announcement.
But I've been saying the same thing for years now. So we're going to trust you're going to figure this out.
It's like you want to have a sign to just hold up awkwardly in the middle of the service that says, you do you. Good job. You know?
I'm really intrigued by the connections you're making between accommodations in classrooms that are working for people and how that translates to church for two reasons. One, I want to hear some new ideas, but two, being in a church that is lucky and blessed to have youngish children of a variety of age ranges, I get to be reminded more often that the children are fine, A, but B, they are being raised with a whole different set of expectations than even I was. And I'm like not young anymore, but I'm not that old either. Like, there are totally teachers I had that are still teaching, I would assume. And how that sort of social shift is happening largely off the radar of the church, I think, in a lot of ways, unless they're a church that has really been intentional about incorporating that.
Yeah, I think that seems accurate, right? I think about like what church for me growing up. I grew up Southern Baptist, so a very different style of service than the Episcopal Church, right? But I think about growing up and basically like you sit there and absorb and you listen a lot, right? And you stand to sing at the beginning and you stand to sing at the end, and more or less that's kind of it. Otherwise, you're just sitting in the pew. And I think how similar that is to how education also was when I was a child, right? It's a lot of sitting at a desk and listening and following instructions. And that's not what, you know, current models of education suggest. So it is a very different thing, right? Our kids move around the classroom pretty freely. They're expected to, you know, have a higher level of kind of responsibility and independence than students were when I think we were kids. And it's just routine to provide different options. So I, you know, I'm sitting on a wobble stool right now because a wobble stool is better for me than a desk chair because I can move around. And our classrooms have wobble stools, and a lot of our students choose to use those. Or they might have other kind of motion, like ways to engage their bodies, right? And I think about how in churches, there's so little flexible seating, right? Even just the basics of in my classroom, if a child needs to go stand in the back, they can do that. If a child needs to, you know, come have a seat on the floor, that's great. We have cushions for floor seating. We have the wobble stools. Like I said, there's all sorts of options. And in a church, and especially in most Episcopal churches, you've got like pews.
Pews. Yep. And that's it.
And for lots of reasons, pews are not the best seating for many, many people. They're beautiful. And they carry, you know, they carry the weight of the prayers that have, you know, been offered there in those seats. But if you have chronic pain or any number of other things, they're not great.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that that's where we kind of wound up in the tradition, because if you look at cathedrals and the older traditions, they are incredibly flexible and you have all kinds of movable seating. And if you look at some of the other Christian traditions, if you look at Eastern Christianity, et cetera, people are up and around and moving all the time, or, you know, coming in and out as needed. And it's, and it's fine. It's much more flexible, and it's completely part of the tradition. It wasn't made up recently.
Exactly.
What is something you have either encountered in the classroom or had to develop in a classroom that you then turned around and was like, oh, the church should apply this in this way?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good question. So one thing that happens, I think, a lot is that we put a lot of work into developing a variety of ways to engage children in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do such a great job of figuring out a variety of ways to engage adults, right? So when we're working with kids, we give them many options for how to learn, how to take in information, as well as for how to express their knowledge, right? And that is very rare in the church, I think, right? There's a lot of kind of straightforward, here's the input, we will all engage the input together, and then we will all respond to it in this manner. And I just wonder, you know, how much richer spiritual formation could be if there were more options, if that was the norm to say, you know, here's what we want to like learn about, and here's what we want to engage with and explore. Here are some ways you can do that. And then when we come back together, there's going to be kind of these three separate ways to work with that.
What you're describing sounds both very similar to a lot of like godly play work and messy church style services.
Exactly. That right there.
And we don't do it for, you're right, we don't do it for adults. And like, you don't know what you don't know as far as the learning needs and the spiritual needs of a lot of your people necessarily, because you only get the people who are going to come to a book club or who are going to do, I mean, this is an ongoing issue. It certainly resonates for me in my congregation. You know, you find out people have so many questions and so many things they're interested in, but they're not going to come to a book club because that's just maybe not how they learn.
Or they're terrified of being wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, they grew up in a time period where being wrong was received differently. We'll say that. So they don't want to raise their hand and be wrong.
You know, it's funny. The kind of educational models are much more focused on exploring, right? Mm-hmm. And experimenting and wondering. But I think that for so many of our adults, that space is closed off for exactly that reason. There's an idea that there is an answer. And if I do not have that answer, then that's it. I'm just wrong. And there's no like wiggle room there or space to just kind of explore together. I think it's very easy for things to turn into kind of a debate when we're doing discussions and stuff as adults. And it's not particular to church. I think that is common to most adult communities. But, you know, I would love for us to find ways to make space to wonder and explore in community in a way that didn't feel like I need to, you know, defend my personhood. And it's hard, right? Because so many of us, you know, come to this place of church leadership, whether we're clergy or laity, because we were well formed in these structures, right? And we love them and they work for us. And it's hard then to step outside of that and say, what's going to work for others? How do we make room for others at this table instead of just saying, I'm sure there's another table for you out there. Why don't you go look for it?
Well, and I know that one of the things I've had to work against is, and I have worked with many, many lovely, talented, thoughtful, creative lay people, but the church has an expectation of what I'm going to do. And the kind of answers I'm going to bring and the kind of content I'm going to bring. And there's only so much sort of resistance to that that you can do before it becomes toxic.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for so many of us, we're also kind of maxed out on the number of plates we can keep spinning at a time, right? Mm-hmm. So if the attitude is, oh, that's a great idea, like you should try that and pursue it, but without taking anything else off, then there's not space for that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very true. I also think in order to get ordained in this tradition, if you are different in any way from whatever the default is, and I think we all know what the default is, you have to shut up and kind of just be really good at certain things and prove really hard that you're really good at certain things. So it kind of like you can lose, I think along the way, you can lose track of some of those other things that maybe where the creativity is or that, you know, kind of inspired you to wind up in this ordained, wind up ordained in the first place, right? Like you talked about the ordination process at the beginning, you have to do certain things and you have to appear a certain way. And then to get through that and then see what's left, I guess, maybe after sometimes you may be missing pieces of yourself after it. I mean, that's sort of the really doom and gloom kind of way of putting it, but I think that is a thing.
Yeah. I was telling a friend the other day, we were talking about getting together soon, and she said, I'm so glad I'm going to get to see you. I wanted to talk with you about something, about a direction I'm considering pursuing. And we were texting, so I sent her a like string of exclamation points, and she said, not the priesthood, not that. And I said, oh, dear one, you were so involved in my process. There's no way anybody who was that up close and personal in this would then say, you know what I want to do? I want to do that too. That's a great idea.
This sounds like a good idea. No.
No. No, I'm glad that wasn't it.
And it is so hard to come out of that process. I think for many people, at least, it's really hard to come out of that process with an idea that there is room for flexibility in what it means to be a priest, right? And so, hence the kind of like mental crisis I went through as I got diagnosed with lupus and was figuring out that, no, I can't be out of my home for 10 hours a day. That's just not an option. And then kind of saying, well, can I be in ministry?
In 10 hours out of your house a day should not be a requirement for anyone's job on a regular basis. Like maybe a couple of days a year that are either a crisis happened or it was well known in advance and you could plan for it. But like, that's not how this world should work.
Yeah, that's a challenge. And I think, so many ministers struggle with that. And I don't know how to make it better, because I think so much of it depends on a congregation's culture, whether there's flexibility there. But if there isn't, and you're somebody whose body doesn't work that way.
I think people wind up sacrificing their physical health on the altar of what the priest is supposed to do, what the clergy is supposed to do, or what the highly involved lay people even really are supposed to do, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's a conversation I have with people too, because I have wonderful lay leaders here and I have conversations about like, you don't have to be here all the time doing all the things, right? Like, or don't apologize if you needed a day off, or don't apologize if whatever happened, right? Like, you're not a machine. You're not a robot. Your person, you know?
I would be interesting to talk to parish volunteers in different places I've been since I started doing this. But I started thanking people when they said I can't come because I'm sick or I'm not feeling well. Thank you for prioritizing your care. We will be fine. Mm-hmm. We will miss you, but thank you for taking care of yourself. It at least changed something for me so I could operate out of that space more often. I hope it's had broader effects on the culture where it's like, oh yeah, this is, I'm not feeling at this.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, moving to school ministry was provided a much more structured day and structured expectations of when I was supposed to be available. And, you know, I pretty well know in advance if I'm supposed to be here late or on a weekend, right, on an off day. It's a very different kind of, yeah, structure for being a priest, framework for being a priest. And it was one that definitely ended up working well for my body. I was nervous about it at first because it's also super physically demanding. But yeah, just that space to know when you are on and when you're off is huge.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm torn between wanting to know more about like the transition from sort of parish work to school work and how that affected your health and how your health was, might have or might not have been a factor in that, and wanting to turn to some more like things to think about at different points in a worship service. Where would you like to go?
I mean, I'm happy to say a few more sentences about kind of that transition and what that was like. Are you curious about anything in particular?
I mean, I think as many of us did during the pandemic, there were moments where I was like, what would it look like if I went and did anything else?
Literally anything else. Yes.
And one of the considerations that I always came back to is like, there are very few jobs where I have like the independence and flexibility I have in this one. And that is a significant accommodation for me. And I was like, I don't know if I can actually lose that and still function. That is not the reason I wound up staying, but there were some days where it was why I didn't quit.
That's really fair. Yeah, I think for me, I was feeling really called to pursue school ministry, but, you know, I was really anxious about it because there are very clear hours when I'm supposed to be here. And I'd had a great deal of flexibility before in kind of setting my own schedule for being on site. And then it's a very active thing. Like I teach a lot of classes. I'm expected to be all over the building during the day. And I just didn't know how any of that would go. But then the trade-off was that I did have much clearer structure. I knew when I was done for the day. I knew what the expectations were. I knew that I didn't need to answer emails in the evening. And I knew that I would get more time with my family on the weekends, right? Because I don't work Sunday mornings and, you know, my spouse was not part of my church community. So, and I think that the trade-off with the predictability was really good for my body in terms of it being able to get into like a rhythm that worked. Parish and university ministry was brutal because there would be days when you are there at 8 a.m. and also have to be working until 9 p.m. And that is just not good. It's like not healthy for anyone. And like for my body, it just tore me up.
No, that makes sense. Yeah, and I think every clergy has had the day where you're like, I'm all done, and then the phone rings or someone walks into your office and you're like, and that's another 3+ hours of work.
And I'm not done. Yep, that's right.
I'm not done, yeah. And I'm not about to be done.
And like, I have a pastoral emergencies to deal with. Like, we have crises that emerge, and I am obviously right in the middle of that. And I'm on the admin team at school. So if it's a crisis, it's a pastoral crisis, I'm in it. And if it's a like leadership crisis situation, I'm in it. But I know that people are going to get in touch with me if I'm needed because other people know what's happening, right? Mm-hmm. There are more people to kind of share the load with, and there are more people to step in and help, right?
That is huge. Mm-hmm.
I bet there's some great schools hiring right now. I'm just saying.
Today, we've been in conversation with Kristen Tossel-Pitts, and we had such an interesting conversation with Kristen that we wound up breaking it into two separate episodes. So you've just listened to the first part, and we look forward to having the second part out next month and hear a little bit more of our conversation. But Robin, we wanted to reflect briefly on this first section.
This was the section that was a gift. We weren't necessarily planning on this delightful exploration of what it is to be a leader, especially in the church, and be a disabled leader, especially in the church. But it was so beautiful and so rich. We're really happy it was there.
Because we went into this interview with the idea in mind of trying to provide a lot of concrete, practical information about accessibility and worship. And some of that was in this first section, and you'll get a ton of that in the next episode. So hopefully these two episodes will serve in multiple ways. Yeah, we had this whole conversation with Kristen about what it's like to feel like you can't be honest about how much your health situation, in her case, is affecting your work and your ordination process, and how she gradually came to realize that this was something that lined up with things that are important to her, and she wanted to talk about it and wanted to be open about it. There's something that she says in here about how she thinks most of us who are ordained, and I'm sure people in certain other professions and other vocations as well, have this immediate desire to turn around and teach. The moment we experience something new, like, I have to tell you about this.
The fancy word for that is just evangelism.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it seems like that was part of the motivation, is that she suddenly realized that was part of the vocation, that was part of her calling, that there were things that she learned, and keeping them to herself was basically eventually became impossible.
I mean, I want to pause and nuance this just a little bit, because she also talks about like the vulnerability of some spaces where you do need to be sort of aware of what you are sharing and how much you are sharing, which is definitely also part of what it is to be a clergy person. But there are times and places where disclosing health information is not always safe. And she talked really sensitively about being in those spaces through the ordination process at times.
I feel like we're a little bit like, you know, kind of this record, like to use a very old metaphor, but we're like a record that's just stuck on the same thing over and over again. I feel like we're saying many of the same things over again in podcast after podcast, but I hope it's not just because we don't know what else to talk about. I hope people can understand as they're listening, it's because we're hearing it from different places. It's coming back over and over again. The vulnerability of the ordination process, and there are other places, it's not just people getting ordained, but the vulnerability in certain spaces in the church around health issues, around disability, unfortunately, it's a real thing. It's very, very vulnerable. We are theoretically an incarnational faith. Yet we don't, in practice, always behave as if we understand that.
We would often like to be an incarnational faith with the bodies we would like to have instead of the bodies people actually come to church with.
Right.
Including oftentimes your clergy person.
So we hear this over and over again from people, you know, it is, if I had had XYZ when I got ordained, I would not have been ordained. Or if I had told people the level of my exhaustion, for example, what Kristen says, that would have been a problem for me. I was still in the middle of the process. Or if I had, you know, I certainly felt that way too. If people knew how hard things were for certain things were, or how I didn't know how I was going to solve certain accessibility problems, that would have caused further issues in my ordination.
Yeah, we return to it because it is a repeated refrain once you start listening to the people whose story it is.
And I really want to highlight and raise it up because I don't think the church can afford to keep making this mistake.
No, we can't. Both because we lose all sorts of beautiful, talented, gifted, called people who happen to have limitations related to health, but also because as we learn more and more about COVID-19 and the health impacts of these last few years, this is going to apply to more and more people.
That's right. And leadership determines the tone of things for everybody else, whether that's lay leadership or whether that's ordained leadership. That's
sets the tone for what is possible or unacceptable in a congregation or community and what's not, and what's not, whether you can bring your whole self or you can't.
Well, and I know I have sat with more than one, not just parishioner, but person who, when they find out I'm ordained, one of the reactions I will commonly get is, oh, X happened, and what I received, and sometimes very explicitly and sometimes very implicitly, is that I was no longer welcome. And almost always, I always believe them, that is what they received. But almost always it is something that I don't, and I would say even most of the church today would not see as a barrier. But it has lived as like this source, a burden and a source of shame with this person for so long.
And in this episode, we also talked a lot about universal design.
I did get a link from Kristen to share as part of our liner notes for a good sort of overview of universal design. So that will go in there.
I don't know if people think about this concept of universal design very often, and if they understand that making things accessible for, you know, with one particular need in mind tends to make things easier for almost everybody. Robin, I listened to the rough draft, audio draft of the episode, and I actually kind of laughed out loud when you mentioned the potato peeler, the vegetable peeler.
Yeah, it's a great example. I love it because it is just so subtle, we don't think about it.
It is absolutely perfect. And we 100% had, or somebody that I knew, some adult that I knew, had that very uncomfortable all metal one with the open metal handle when I was a kid. And we definitely do not have that in my kitchen. We have the squishy one with the rubber grip. And it's just so much easier. And neither I nor my spouse has any issues with our hands. We could use any vegetable peeler we wanted, but why would we when we have the nice squishy one?
Why make it harder than it has to be?
That's a wonderful and very concrete example. But why make anything harder than it has to be?
The process is hard because of what it asks you to reevaluate and consider and take in and grow. We don't need to add things to make it hard. If you are going to engage in, whether it's ordination or any other sort of discernment process or training, you are going to grow and learn.
Right.
That is why you are doing the training. So you can grow and learn and become better skilled and better able to do the thing. You don't need to make it harder.
You don't need to find ways that are outside of the essential aspects of the thing to make it difficult.
That's a good way of putting it.
I think a lot of times we see it's not just in the church. I don't just throw the church under the bus, but I think we see a lack of creativity around what is possible. And I think a lot of what Kristen is talking about, and she'll talk about in the next episode, is also about learning to just think a little bit more creatively. And like, does something have to be a certain way just because we haven't thought that there would be any other way to do it? If it's shutting people out, maybe that's not a necessary way to do it.
She has a line, and it's something Kristen says about the gospel asks us to pick the option that works for people who don't get that other places.
Yes, I wrote that down. I think that's in the second episode.
Okay, maybe it's in the second part.
But I think it's worth repeating.
Yeah, but it seems so relevant to this. Like, the things that would take it too far are really such a short list. And the things that create space for people who the rest of the world will not offer that space to are so often of the gospel.
I guess the one other thing I wanted to touch on maybe really quickly, and this is in both episodes, but because we'll come back to it again, is the importance of the online worship. And then she speaks a little bit further in the second episode about education, formation offerings and things like that, leadership opportunities, things like that. But using the online capacity that we all know we have now, and how it made things possible for her and how many other people it makes things possible for.
The concept that if you can't do it well, there's no point is so much less true than anything worth doing is worth doing badly. because it's better than not offering it at all. So if you have heard or you're like, I could see us doing the thing and doing it this way and it would be beautiful, that might be true, but not doing it because it's not the most perfect version of it, it is not better.
Right.
So if you are in a place like I am, where for a lot of Sundays, live stream is like a device on a tripod and we push the go live button and we trust it works enough. For someone in your community, that is an amazing sign that God has not forgotten them.
Absolutely. And you know, and that is, if most of us waited for the high production values or the multiple camera angles or the whatever, we wouldn't be doing this.
Part of the reason we went with the iPad, it's not an iPad, it's like a tablet on a tripod, is I believe that's sustainable. So if something were to happen to me and I had to stop being the priest there, that will outlive me. If I spent, you know, a month and learned the high production values and then I had to stop being the priest there, those values leave with me. Now, maybe your setup is different, but sustainability is worth honoring in this.
You know, and the same thing with Zoom. We still, are we perfect on our Zooms? No. Do we still have to remind people to mute and unmute? Sure, it happens all the time. But it doesn't matter. It's people are able to participate. And we're finding that people, you know, again, it, the universal design concept, it's not just that people are participating who are unable to be there for some reason related to disability or illness or being a care provider or something like that, which is true in a number of cases, but not always. But we're also finding that we're able to collaborate and do things across space and time that we couldn't, that we didn't realize we could do before.
We hope you enjoyed this as much as we did. We hope you find someone to talk about it with or share it with. And next month you can come back and hear the more worship accessibility heavy part of the conversation, which was also so good.
You've been listening to The Accessible Altar, a podcast at the intersection of faith and disability, hosted by Robin King and Stephanie Shockley. We record on the traditional land of the Lenni Lenape and Treaty 6 territory.
If you like The Accessible Altar, please rate and review us wherever you find podcasts.
For additional information about anything we talked about in this episode, as well as a transcript of the show, check out the show notes on our website, www.accessiblealtar.com.
We are on Twitter and Instagram as @AccessibleAltar, and join us on our Facebook page at The Accessible Altar.
If you have questions, feedback, or ideas for future episodes, email us at accessiblealtar@gmail.com.